Okay, I think we can start. A couple of things some of you might be interested in. I only plan to cover on the midterm exam questions through the end of chapter 3, which means basically through the end of last time's lecture. And also, if you haven't seen them yet, my solutions to homework set 3 are posted online. Please read through them and tell me if you find any mistakes. Have you found any mistakes yet? You can't answer that. I had started proving a couple of final Bessel function identities last time. I didn't quite get through, but they're in the notes, and you can go through this last page about that on page 98 of the notes if you're interested. These are sometimes useful, and in particular, if you're ever asked to do two-dimensional scattering in quantum mechanics, you will need this equation. Also, there are a couple of pages after page 98 in the notes I'm not going to cover in lecture about proving direct delta function orthogonality of Bessel functions and more general, the showing how you can prove this when you have continuum indices in your separated variable solutions. If you have continuous indices, you get a direct delta function orthogonality, and you can prove it quite general for all Sturm-Liouville equations. And I go through that in I think, page 99 and 100. It's a method, I think, that's not really covered in Jackson, but we use this all the time in quantum mechanics, this kind of method that's laid out there. So I think it's useful to know. Okay, so chapter 4 actually deals with two topics. One, the first, and it's going to occupy us fully today, is multiple expansions. What we mean by that, what I mean by a multiple expansion is what we have is we're going to try to find phi of x, which is produced by a very localized, very sort of tiny region where there is charge. And mostly we are talking about the electrostatic potential out far away from that charge. But there are a few exceptions to that. Sometimes we'll want to actually go right in, right around the charge. But most of this deals with looking far away from the charges. The second part of this chapter, which we won't get to today, is looking at electric fields and energy considerations in macroscopic media. This is a really hard problem in general. If you start getting into media, you know, there are things like dielectric constant we'll be talking about. These are approximate ways of talking about what's happening in media. To really do full justice to that part, we really would need a full quantum treatment. And even then, we would make a ton of approximations. So I view the jump in chapter 4 to media as sort of a little bit less 100% solid based only on Maxwell's equations. In vacuum. But anyway, we'll talk about that, about all the approximations we'll have to make, how we'll try to develop pictures like people did successfully before even the invention of quantum mechanics to talk about these kinds of systems a little bit from a more experimental point of view. Because basically, you have a chunk of material, you apply electric fields to it. What does the electric field do to the chunk of material or liquid? It's going to start rearranging, polarizing the material, make like the positive charges go kind of being pushed along the direction of the field and start rearranging to some degree the charges in the material, inducing dipole moments and so on, and it gets much more complicated. Okay, so anyway, that's something you can all look forward to. But today we're going to do a simpler thing, which is also very important. Okay, so what we're going to do with the multiple expansion is we want to find the behavior of potentials and field that are produced by a very localized row. I guess I've already said all this. And you can think, if you want to have an example in your head, imagine a nucleus, got a tiny bit of charge, very, very tiny scale, 10 to the minus 15 meters. And the electron cloud around it, even in the ground state, has a lot of electrons that are orders of magnitude most of the time far, far away from this nucleus. So what is the electric field that, or the potential energy of those electrons in that field? Nuclei aren't all just spherical balls. Some have odd shapes and so on. And so this is a non-trivial problem, but we have all the tools really to talk about that. And the fact that there is such a difference in distance scales between the extent of the charges and where we want to know the potential, far orders of magnitude outside, allows us to develop a pretty simple theoretical description of that. Okay, so the idea here is we are going to try to, the concept of this derivation is to characterize the fields far away from the distribution to as much as possible by just a few parameters. Once you know those parameters for any given system, you don't need to know every fine detail of the charge distribution. It will be enough to know these parameters. And by parameters here, I'm talking about things like the charge, of course. It's the most important, the total charge of that distribution. There will be an electric dipole moment of the distribution we'll talk about in detail. There might be higher moments that are sometimes important, the electric quadrupole moment, and so on. So let's set up the math. I think I only had two visitors to my office hours yesterday. It was very sad. if you are struggling with the material, it's important not to be embarrassed to ask questions. So either come and ask me or ask someone who knows, who can give you the answers. And don't be embarrassed to ask. It's really important. This, I think, was one of the most important things I learned as a graduate student, was to get over being embarrassed asking questions when I didn't understand something. It's not a small thing. Okay, so let's set up a coordinate system. Again, kind of visualizing we're talking about maybe a nuclear charge distribution. Here is our nucleus. And maybe it looks like that. And it has some rho of x prime. A source charge is localized to this tiny region of the size of the nucleus. And we are going to ask, what is the potential at an observation point, maybe at the distance of an electron? This might be of the order of angstroms or more, some orders of magnitude far away from the nucleus at a vector x at our observation point. And, of course, to find the Hamiltonian, you need in quantum mechanics, you'll need the energy, you'll need the electrostatic potential at that point produced by the nucleus charge distribution. So this might be complicated in general. Of course, there are some nuclei that are more or less spherical blobs, like a closed shell nucleus. But there are plenty of nuclei that might look kind of elongated or distorted. And so to summarize the effects felt by these large distances away, we will do an expansion, use an expansion of the electrostatic potential. So here we're talking about free space, no boundaries, and well, we know the formula. We just add up all the bits of charge, each tiny bit of charge in this distribution produces an infinitesimal electrostatic potential. And we add them all up using the Leibniz notation for adding. When you have a continuous distribution, this elongated S rho of x prime over the distance between x and x prime. We add up every bit, is producing a little contribution. But now I'll plug in here our spherical harmonic expansion for this 1 over the distance between x and x prime. Namely, 5x is sum over all L, sum over M from minus L to plus L, 4 pi over 2L plus 1. Let's not forget our 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Right, now we have an R lesser and an R greater. And because we said we're far away, all the R lesser will be R prime here, and R greater will be the magnitude of R. So let's go ahead and move the r prime part of this inside of this integral. Integral d cubed x prime, r prime to the L, ylm conjugate of x hat prime, rho of x prime. That's all the dependents on the prime coordinates are now inside that integral. And then finally, it's times 1 over r to the L plus 1. And it depends on the angle we look at. The x hat, meaning theta phi coordinates, in whatever coordinate system we've chosen. Okay. So there are a bunch of constants in here that are properties of our charge distribution. And we're going to simplify our notation, call these some spherical multiple moments. Of our charge distribution, and we'll study these in detail. And in that simpler notation, we just have 5x is 1 over epsilon naught, sum over L and M, QLM over 2L plus 1, YLM of x hat, or meaning theta and phi, over r to the L plus 1. And again, now remember, we said we were very far away, and that should mean this series should converge quickly. We might only need a few L's in that expansion to get a very accurate description. Right, in our nucleus electron example, this might be 10 to the 5, this distance compared to the distances in Q. And so this could converge very quickly. Okay, so we have a way to characterize the electrostatic potential in terms of these constant properties of our static charge distribution. Let's lay out a few of the basic properties of these multiple moments. So first, we know that QL minus M has to equal minus 1 to the M QLM conjugate. These are complex constants as I've defined them. And this is just because of the properties of the YLMs when you complex conjugate the YLMs. That's the only complex thing in that integral. Second property that I want to cover is, let's start looking at the individual QLMs. The first is Q0, 0, L equals 0, M equals 0. Right, this is just 1 over root 4 pi times the integral of the charge and nothing else. We are assuming, of course, the charge distribution is finite in extent. And so we just have to integrate over that finite volume containing it. Okay, well, this is just the total charge of that distribution. And we have to keep track of this root 4 pi factor, which is part of the definition of Q0, 0. The next one, with L equals 1 terms, contribute to what we call the electric dipole. And here there are three terms, right? M goes from minus L to L. So L is 1, M is minus 1, 0, and 1. And so Q1, 1, for instance, is minus, if we plug in what Y1, 1 conjugate is in this definition of QLM, we have the integral d cubed x prime of r prime. Now, remember there was an r prime to the L. And here's our spherical harmonic, 3 over 8 pi to the 1 half sine theta prime e to the minus I phi prime rho of x prime is one of the three components. The others you can write out explicitly if you want. But I want to introduce a little bit of a, we're going to talk so much about electric dipoles, I want to introduce a slightly condensed notation for them, for this integral. And in particular, it's useful, not only here, but in many other applications, to introduce the spherical coordinate unit vectors. Actually, let me rephrase that. I want to introduce the spherical unit vectors. I shouldn't have said spherical coordinate unit vectors. And you'll see what I mean in a second. The spherical coordinate unit vectors would be what we've already introduced, right? R hat, theta hat, phi hat. That's not what I'm talking about now. The spherical unit vectors are defined as follows. They are combinations of the Cartesian unit vectors, which have a simple behavior under coordinate rotations. And in particular, I like to define, and this is a pretty standard definition, epsilon hat plus or minus 1 are defined to be minus or plus x hat minus I y hat all over square root of 2. And epsilon hat 0 is simply the z unit vector. I think there are a few places in Jackson where he uses something similar to this but defined differently. So if you're comparing or grabbing formulas from my notes and from Jackson's, you might have to be careful about that, that you don't mix our notation with Jackson's. Now, one advantage of writing it this way is that you can actually write the spherical harmonics with L equals 1 simply in terms of these. Let me show you what I mean. In fact, the L equals 1 spherical harmonics are simply y1 comma mu of theta prime phi prime, which is what I've also been calling x hat prime, are in fact equal to square root of 3 over 4 pi x prime vector over r, right, which will be a quantity independent of the length of the vector, has only angular information in this vector x prime, simply dotted into the mu-th spherical unit vector. I'll quickly go through an example to show you that this works for one case. Then you can either trust me or if you don't trust me, we're in trouble. But you can verify it yourself if you don't trust me. Okay, so here's a quick check. Let's see, does y11 of theta prime phi prime equal, in fact, what I just claimed, 3 over 4 pi to the 1/2, the x prime vector over r. I guess I'm doing this without the prime coordinates now. Let me take the primes off. What is the x vector divided by r? It's x over r. X hat, here, x hat means the x, the Cartesian coordinate x, not theta phi, like I sometimes am writing it. Where did I write it? Here. I don't mean that kind of an x hat. Then we have y over r, y hat, z over r, z hat, dotted into x plus 1 hat that I just defined over there. Which is minus x hat minus I y hat over root 2. Well, you can take these dot products, of course, use the orthonormality of the Cartesian unit vectors and get minus 3 over 8 pi to the 1/2 sine theta cos phi plus I sine theta sine phi. And by golly, that is in fact minus 3 over 8 pi to the 1/2 sine theta e to the I phi, which is the spherical harmonic y11. Okay, so that checks. Another property, by the way, of these spherical unit vectors is their orthonormality. But you have to remember when you take a dot product that it's a conjugated dot product. In other words, epsilon hat mu conjugate dotted into epsilon nu hat is a Kronecker delta. Mu nu. It's 1 if mu equals nu. It's 0 if mu is different from nu. As another aside, while we're talking about these three unit vectors, they are, of course, completely equivalent to x hat, y hat, and z hat. They contain the exact same amount of information. And so, in particular, any vector in three dimensions can be written in terms of these. And one way I like to write that is, and these are sometimes called then the spherical tensor components of the vector. I like to write this way. P, say, a general vector, we'll be using this for the electric dipole moment in a few minutes, but this could be any vector in three dimensions. You could write this as a sum from mu going from minus 1 to 1 of epsilon mu, the unit vector, times epsilon mu hat star dotted into that vector. You can do this for any vector. And I like to think that this structure is exactly what you all learned in your first quantum courses, where you found that there is a unit operator you can use to write any wave function psi, right, as a sum over a complete set of states mu, mu. Acting on psi. And in that sense, the unit operator in quantum mechanics is often said to equal, in our whatever is our Hilbert space, a sum over the kets times the bras. Well, this structure is just the same as this. This is like the sum, including the sum, is like the unit operator in three-dimensional vector space. Just like this is in Hilbert space. Okay, so let's rewrite Q11 in this notation and start talking about the properties of dipoles, electric dipoles. If any of you are going into ultra-cold physics, by the way, polar molecules and other systems with dipole moments, both electric and magnetic, it's a very big topic in cold atom physics right now. I'm trying to make, like, the first Bose condensate of polar molecules, it was made for the first time this year. Was it this year or last year? Last year. Okay. Anyway, it's just very recent. And they had to know all this stuff to do that. Okay, so in this notation, what is Q11? Can get a rather simple expression for it. 3 over 4 pi to the 1/2 epsilon hat plus 1 conjugate. Dotted into the integral d cubed x prime of x prime rho of x prime. Or more simply, it's this factor we have to not forget about, and the unit vector epsilon plus 1 conjugated dotted into the electric dipole moment vector. P. Right, so P, which is defined to be integral d cubed x prime, rho of x prime, is the conventional definition of the electric dipole moment of the charge distribution. And P is usually the quantity that people care about and try to characterize everything, energy, electric field, and so on. Potential, electric potential is usually, we try to express everything in terms of this vector. Okay. And you probably all learned, like in your undergraduate, if you have a positive charge and a negative charge separated by a distance d, then P is the vector pointing in the direction of the positive charge, which is, if this is charge Q and minus Q, is Q, the magnitude of P is Q times d. Which you can quickly derive if you want to confirm that this corresponds to that situation. Plug in two delta function charges, equal and opposite, separated by distance d into here. Do this integral and you can confirm that. So we have Q11 here. Let's write the other ones. Q10. Well, let me make a different table. Get a piece of chalk. Okay, so let's write them all out, have all the three components in front of us. Minus 1 over root 2 px minus ipy in terms of the components of this ordinary vector p now. And then there's this factor 3 over 4 pi to the 1 half. There is the Q10, which is that same factor, 3 over 4 pi to the 1 half, epsilon 0 star dot p, which is also this 3 over 4 pi to the 1 half, simply the z component. And Q 1 minus 1, 3 over 4 pi to the 1 half, epsilon hat star minus 1 dotted into P, which is 3 over 4 pi to the 1 half, Px plus Ipy over root 2. So these are the three moments for L equals 1, written in terms of the conventional notation of an ordinary electric dipole moment vector, which whose definition, this P here, is very easy to remember. Okay. You won't need that on your cheat sheet. It will be in your head. Now and forevermore. I think this was all point 3. So now we're at point 4. Let's look at L equals 2. Follow our momentum. We're going. We're going strong. We can do this. Electric quadrupole moment. So there are five moments for L equals 2. M goes from minus L to plus L. Let's write one of them with L equals 2, M equals 2. Q22, as an example, is the integral d cubed x prime. Going back to our general multiple expansion, we had these QLMs, remember, and they involve r prime to the L, so R prime squared for L equals 2, and then there is a Y22 conjugate of theta prime phi prime, and then there's a rho of X prime. Now let me remind you, Y22 conjugate, you can look up in Jackson or type it into Mathematica and remind yourself, at least I don't usually have all this memorized beyond the L equals 1 spherical harmonics, 15 over 2 pi to the 1 half sine squared theta prime. I forget, I might have forgotten the square in the notes, so you might double check that and correct your notes if I did. E to the minus 2i phi prime. And we can do what we did with the dipole, rewrite this in terms of our spherical unit vectors. Okay. And the Cartesian components. So basically, this Y22 conjugate I'm claiming, as I've written in the notes, could also write as 1/4 15 over 2 pi to the 1 half, the quantity x prime minus iy prime over R quantity squared. So we could plug that in this integral and get another form for Q22 as a quarter 15 over 2 pi to the 1/2 integral x prime minus I y prime squared rho of x prime d cubed x prime. And now at this point, like we re-express these little QLMs for L equals 1 in terms of the kind of conventional idea of an electric dipole moment as just the integral of x times rho, there is a similar notation we're going to need for the quadrupole to express the QLMs, the five numbers that are non-zero for L equals 2 in terms of a little simpler, easier to remember, and more conventionally talked about quantities. Okay, so in particular, we will re-express QLM, little QLM, in terms of the Cartesian coordinate quadrupole moment tensor components which we'll call capital Q with an underscore because it's basically a matrix. So let me give you that definition. So Q22 will be written as 1/12 15 over 2 pi to the 1/2 times Q11 minus IQ12 minus Q22. Right, where the 2 basically, the 1, 2, and 3 really mean x, y, and z components. So I'm using Jackson's notation. You could write that qxx, qxy, qyy. But you can see when you expand this, you're going to have, right, a term with x prime squared, a term, a cross term with x and y, and then a term with y squared, which will be the q to give the capital Q22 term. Okay, so similarly, just let me give the others, like Q21 is minus 15 over 8 pi to the 1/2, the integral of z prime times x minus I y prime rho of x prime d cubed x prime, which in terms of Cartesian components would be rewritten as minus a third 15 over 8 pi to the 1/2 capital Q13 minus I capital Q23. In a hopefully becoming obvious notation. And lastly, Q20 is 1/2 5 over 4 pi to the 1/2 integral 3z prime squared minus r prime squared rho of x prime d cubed x prime is written as 1/2 5 over 4 pi to the 1/2 times capital Q 3/3. So let me give you the general definition of capital Q, which is the quantity you'll normally be talking about if someone asks you, what's the quadrupole moment of iron 58 nucleus? Someone might ask you that one day. They'll want you to give them these numbers. XI prime, XJ prime, these are the Cartesian components of the vector X prime, minus R prime squared delta IJ times rho of X prime d cubed X prime. That's the simple definition of the quadrupole moment Cartesian tensor. Electric. So, if you recall, these QLMs, we had a formula for phi of x produced by each different L order. We've talked already about the monopole moment, the charge caused by the total charge. We've talked about the electric dipole moment, although we're going to talk a lot more. And now we can add in the quadrupole terms. So let me write our expansion in this new notation for the electric potential far away from this charge distribution. As an infinite series, which will normally truncate to the first few L values. There will be our obligatory 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. There will be Q over the distance from whatever is our origin we chose in that charge distribution, somewhere in the middle normally. The distance to that point we chose. Then there will be a term p dot x, the observation point, observation vector x from that origin, divided by r cubed. So this term falls off like 1 over distance squared in the potential, because there is an r magnitude in the vector x. And then the quadrupole terms like are a little more complicated, a double sum over all three x and y components, xi, qij, xj over r to the fifth, which falls off like 1 over a distance cubed at long range. We could keep going farther, and I would really like to, because one of my favorite words in the English language is hexadecapole. The next term after the quadrupole will be octupole. The one after that is hexadecapole. But time is short, and we don't have time for that today, sadly. I have written scientific papers with the word hexadecapole in it. Yes?
I just want to make sure, for Q21, is that supposed to be an x prime next to the z prime?
Yep. Thanks. One thing that is easier to remember than this formula for the quadrupole term is to remember that this is actually a simple double dot product. If I think of the elements of Q as forming a matrix, then I can write this sum as X dotted into the matrix, or 3 by 3 quadrupole tensor, X dot Q dot X. It's a much simpler way, simpler notation for remembering that. Okay. Well, we have the potential. What we're often interested in is the electric field. So let's work that out. We all know how to do that. Let's work it out for a single LM multiple. So E is minus del phi . And let's use the spherical representation of the gradient operator, which you can find, I think it's in the back inside cover of our favorite tome textbook. This operator is, of course, r hat d by dr plus theta hat over r d by d theta plus phi hat over r sine theta d by d phi. And so, sparing you the algebra and the simplifications, er, the radial component of the electric field in spherical coordinates, right? We have our observation point, x hat, is r theta phi, spherical components, the component along this r hat vector, which is along x hat, x vector, is qlm over epsilon naught, l plus 1 over 2l plus 1. Right, because we had 1 over r to the l plus 1. When we differentiate with respect to r, it'll pull out a minus l minus 1. And that the minus sign cancels this minus sign. We're left with a ylm undifferentiated, evaluated at these angles, theta, phi, angles, which I'm abbreviating as x hat as usual. And then we have over r to the l plus 2. So that's one of the components. The theta component, we will have to take this term, of course. We will have minus qlm over epsilon naught times 2l plus 1. 1 over r to the l plus 2 again. D by d theta of ylm of theta phi, which is x hat. And lastly, the phi component of the electric field is minus qlm over epsilon naught 2l plus 1 I times m over r to the L plus 2 sine theta times YLM of X hat. right? You get an IM because the phi dependence of YLM of theta phi is e to the IM phi. So the derivative pulls down this IM. Okay, those are the three components of the electric field. So let's specialize now to the electric dipole case and look at that in some detail. So let's take our electric dipole and align it with the z-axis. In our coordinate system. Okay, so we have our xyz coordinate system, and here is our electric dipole moment of characterizing some charge distribution. So let me again set up my angles. We have our theta. We have its projection onto the xy plane, which is at an angle phi relative to the x-axis. This vector to our observation point has length r, and the vector itself we write as the vector x. Then this is the direction of the radial component of the electric field. It's pointed along r in this coordinate system. The theta, remember, if you tip from your polar axis down by angle theta along that vector, right, that's the theta hat vector, that's the direction that e theta multiplies that unit vector. And then e phi would be in the right-handed coordinate system of e cross, of r cross theta, would be into the board as I've kind of drawn it. So, in fact, E phi for this coordinate system, well, let me just write E, all the components. ER is just 2P cos theta over 4 pi epsilon naught R cubed. And E theta is P sine theta over 4 pi epsilon naught R cubed. And E phi is just zero. Not surprisingly, because P is along the z-axis, so there is, of course, no dependence in the phi angle. Now I'm going to recast this in a more traditional form, which is easier to make coordinate system independent. That takes a little vector manipulations. So first of all, notice that for this P directed along the z-axis, I can write that just in terms of the r-hat and the theta hat unit vectors. I don't need the phi hat unit vectors for P aligned along the z-axis. So this is r hat times P dot r hat plus theta hat P dot into theta hat. And by the way, it'd be a good exercise if you haven't done this, or haven't done it for a long time, to make sure you could know how to write r hat, theta hat, phi hat in terms of x hat, y hat, and z hat. You might make sure you know how to do that. It will pay off to learn how to do that. And if you have trouble, come. In my office hours, we could work it out together. One thing about this which is interesting is I can recast theta hat as just solve this equation for theta hat. I can write it as p minus r hat p dot r hat all over p dot theta hat. And then I can plug in, right, into E is equal to ER R hat plus E theta theta hat. I can plug that in with these for ER and E theta. I can plug in this identity and get E is 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught r cubed times the quantity 2p cos theta r hat plus p sine theta, but I'm going to rewrite theta hat as p minus r hat p dot r hat all over p hat dot, sorry, p dot theta hat. And now I claim that by inspection of the trigonometry here, P, the dot product between P and theta hat is P cosine of pi over 2 plus theta. And that is minus P sine theta. And of course, also P dot R hat is just cos theta times P. So if I plug those in, I get a simplified expression for the electric field produced by this dipole aligned with the z-axis that has no angles explicitly written in the formula. In other words, our electric field now looks like 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught r cubed times 3p dot r hat times r hat minus the full vector p. Much simpler form where we don't have to be thinking about angles. We just have to keep track of vectors and be able to take their dot product. So this is a useful form. We can also generalize it if, for instance, now let's suppose P is not located at the origin. Let's let it be at a source point x naught. It's what we've often been calling x prime, like something at the center of the charge distribution again, but now the charge distribution is somewhere off of the origin at a vector x naught from wherever we chose the origin. Then the formula for the electric field generalizes. We still have 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. We have the distance between x and x naught to the fifth power because it's kind of hard to write the unit vector in the direction x minus x naught. So instead of writing that as a unit vector, I'll write the actual vector between x and x naught explicitly. Then we have this structure. We have p dotted into the vector from x naught to x minus p vector times the distance squared between observation and the dipole. Okay, and so now we have a completely general formula. It's not restricted to a dipole pointing along z, and it's not restricted to a dipole at the origin. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thanks. That goes there. Okay, so this is an important formula. One of the most important formulas, this, or in its simpler form here, if you've chosen your coordinate system at the center of the dipole, you can use this simpler form. But now we have to do some analysis of this electric field, which has some pretty interesting properties we still have to extract by analyzing this formula at one more level of detail. One observation is that if you integrate that electric field expression, this is the electric field due to a dipole only, over a tiny sphere, that's centered on the dipole, the answer is zero. Let me show you what I mean. Remember, we're integrating over all, doing the volume integral over the radius of this sphere, I'm calling capital R, 3p dot r hat times r hat minus p. I'll use the simpler form because I've chosen my origin at the dipole, over r cubed d cubed r. I'm claiming that this is zero, but I should add a caveat to that. I'm assuming we do the angular integral first, because the radial integral will be this integral 0 to capital R of r squared dr over r cubed. And that she done blowed up real good. That diverges. So we do that second. Then it's 0. Okay. But it kind of makes you think, well, that's not real satisfying that I've just cavalierly said 0 times infinity is 0. But let me first convince you why the angular integral is 0. Remember that this numerator, where we started from, this had only components of y2m. We're in that formula to begin with. And of course, the integral of y2m d omega over all solid angles is 0, because you could also think of it this way as being multiplied by y00 conjugate, which is 1 over root 4 pi, which is a constant. And the orthogonality of spherical harmonics tells you that the integral of any spherical harmonics except L equals 0 will give 0. Okay, so that integral is 0. To convince you a little more carefully, I should admit that, well, actually we only showed that the electrostatic potential had only YLMs in it. I didn't actually prove that for the electric field. So if we plug in to that formula R hat, what I recommend you to try to derive these formulas, I'm going to just write them down now, X hat sine theta cos phi plus Y hat sine theta sine phi plus Z hat cos theta. And phi hat is the rate of change of R hat with respect to phi. It has to be in that direction, right? So you change the R vector in phi, make an infinitesimal change. That is the direction of phi hat. Of course, this is not a normalized unit vector, so you have to divide that by the length of it. And that gives minus x hat sine phi plus y hat cos phi. And if you're like me, you might not always remember theta hat off the top of your head, even if r hat and phi hat are pretty simple. But you can form theta hat, since it's a right-handed coordinate system, by taking phi hat cross r hat to get theta hat. And that cross product gives x hat cos theta cos phi plus y hat cos theta sine phi minus z hat sine theta. I think I'm almost out of time of this derivation, but let me just go ahead and just convince you that if I plug this in to my electric field formula, I get the following formula just in terms of spherical harmonics as P over 4 pi epsilon naught R cubed, 8 pi over 15 to the 1/2. This is in the notes, of course, x hat times 3/2. Times minus y21 minus y2 minus 1 plus y hat 3 over 2i minus y21 minus y2 minus 1. And then there is a z hat root 2 y20. Okay, so that's the explicit proof of this, that the electric field can be written entirely from a dipole in terms of L equals 2 spherical harmonics, and therefore the angular integral vanishes. Yes?
I think I must have lost track of something. If it's a dipole, where does the L equals 2 come in? Because I thought those were related to the L equals 1 for dipoles.
Because each, like the R hat, has spherical harmonic components of 1, and this has spherical harmonics. So you have a product of 2 y1m's here, which can be recast in terms of y2m's. Good question. Very good question. Okay, I've kept you a minute longer than you bargained for. Please leave.